Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! My, oh my, ain't it good to be back home again. Minute and a half past the hour. It is Thursday, the 4th of June. I am back in the hills and hollers of what's left of wild, wonderful West Virginia, almost level West Virginia. Back from the Campaign for America's Future. Yes, back from America's Future Now. Conference in Washington, D.C., held on Monday and Tuesday. There was some stuff Wednesday morning, but being as how I don't do mornings, I came on home. Got on a train at 11:10 Eastern Daylight Time in Washington, D.C., was supposed to arrive at my dropping off point at something around, I believe, 6:30 p.m. Got off the train at 8 p.m. Bless their hearts. The Amtrak folks are dedicated professionals, and it drives them nuts to see their human passengers have to give way and priority and pride of place to train loads of, stuff like coal. Yeah, we waited for coal. Coal was more important than us as we came home. So we got home 8 instead of 6:30. But that's about how that route runs. But you know what? I'm convinced that passenger rail's time has not come but returned. Because it's just ever so much more a pleasant experience. No toenail inspections and such foolishness. It just, it's just more pleasant. Want a snack? Go get a snack. Want to walk around a little bit? Stretch your legs. Walk around. Hang out in the lounge car a little bit and watch both sides of the scenery. Yeah. And it is, and I tell you what, from here to there is a beautiful ride. And I am told that the ride out west is absolutely gorgeous, and I'd love to take that in one of those double-decker observation glass-topped cars sometime. I think that'd be breathtaking. Now, for me, on long train rides, there's that addiction thing, nicotine, yada, 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 but, you know, what's a guy to do? I wasn't going to use any... I guess there are people who say, well, okay, I'll rub a little Copenhagen. No. No. Because the rocking motion of the train coupled with the... No. I don't like traveling green. I like being green, but not turning green, if you know what I mean. So it's good to be back home. It's good to be back in the home studio. It was exciting as all get out to be there on Radio Row. And my thanks go out to Candy Stroud and her whole team that put so much of that together in the Campaign for America's Future. Dedicated, absolutely dedicated to creating the new discussion and dialogue in this country that is so desperately needed and in putting those ideas forward and helping them get traction. And I think... We're not going to have all of our victories day after tomorrow, but the weight is out there to push issues in the direction that we need them to go. whether it's issues related to a coal mono economy and how we create the future in Appalachia, to the pressing issue of health care all across this country. And everything in between. If you were listening, you heard a lot of smart people pressing a lot of important topics. And I hope we can be at more and more of the, more and more things just like that. It was good to, you know, it was also good to see in the course of talking with Guy James. He noted that at the very beginning of these things that there'd only be two or three people in the radio row. And Radio Row was absolutely hopping this time through. And I think that's a good sign because it reflects the uptick in the number of people talking about significant liberal issues. I'm a little bit like Guy James on that. I understand the use of the word progressive. But I really, really prefer I prefer the word liberal. And there were a lot of them. Guy and me at the table there, across the way, Cenk Uygur, some folks from XM were there. Of course, Tom Hartman was there. Montel Williams was there. John Elliott, I guess formerly of Air America, was there. I don't know for sure that he's formerly, but he didn't seem to be working with the Air America folks. But there were a lot of representatives of what we hope will be, continue to be, a growing medium. And everyone making the rounds, talking amongst them, just getting the message out as widely as possible. Some of my favorite conversations. I enjoyed our conversation with John Linday. I enjoyed our conversation with Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. You know, there's a tie between what the Alliance for American Manufacturing wants as compared with, say, the critical needs that we have vis-a-vis the Coal River Wind Project, for instance. Because what is hoped to be accomplished with Coal River Wind relies on a future in which we have a substantial green manufacturing economy in this country. So it's nice to see those alliances sort of potentially spring up organically, as it were. It was nice to talk to folks who were involved in trying to put forward the notion of putting our candidates out there with progressive liberal ideals and letting them begin to participate in the process of the advocacy that we heard about for clean elections and the fact that there is a move afoot in Congress. We need to get after that and tell people that we favor it. Now, of course, there will be some congressmen who don't favor it because, you know, they like the paychecks that are being written to them by, oh, I don't know, Massey Energy, Peabody Energy, Consol Energy, you know, just to name a few of the ones that are right here close at hand in my neck of the woods. You know, those $20,000 handshakes are a lot of fun. I mean, you can buy a lot of emery boards and pencils and bags of printed sunflower seeds for campaign season on $20,000 handshakes from Massey Energy and the like. Without a doubt. But there were a lot of good conversations, and even though it was somewhat chaotic and table to table to table to table, Everyone that I dealt with sincerely seemed like they wanted to engage in every conversation for which they were booked. It didn't seem to be a matter of going through the motions, and I appreciated that. Because when you get plopped down in a chair and you don't know who you're talking to, and who you're talking to, they're a brand new face to you, it can be kind of awkward. But I hope we bridge that gap fairly astutely. Of course, in the midst of all of that information, Monday and Tuesday and travel day yesterday, we have been forestalled on a lot of breaking news coverage. So we will have to try to catch up with that this evening. Sad business. I'm still shaken by the murder in Kansas. I'm more shaken, I think, by the response of the for-profit media to it. Some people have called Bill O'Reilly on the carpet, and he has responded in typical weasel form by rejecting any possibility that he calling Dr. Tiller the baby killer, repeatedly had any hand in ratcheting up the insanity among the pasty-faced, doughy white people who inhabit the anti-choice right wing. Nah, I didn't have anything to do with it. No, the guy was a loon! He was a loon! He was crazy! Crazy, crazy, crazy. A loon. And he was such a... You know how much of a loon the guy was who shot Dr. Tiller? This is how much of a loon he was. He was such a loon... Well, first of all, loon is the phrase that Falafel Bill used to describe Dr. Tiller's murderer. He said that he was Scott Roeder was a loon, and then used the murders in Arkansas to claim that if, in fact, he was responsible for Tiller's murder, then Brian Williams at NBC had to be responsible for the murders in Arkansas because NBC talks about torture and what happened in Iraq and what has happened to... But you know what? That coverage hasn't been there. That's part of the problem. We aren't in the streets in horrified indignation, demanding an immediate withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan, because by and large, the American people have not seen the horrors perpetrated in their names in those two sad, sad places. Never mind the fact that Bill O'Reilly at one point said, "And if I could get my hands on Tiller..." And went on to note, NBC has never, ever said a negative word about Tiller's activities, which include aborting an estimated 60,000 fetuses, many of them viable. God almighty. It's simply stunning. So... Yeah, Bill O'Reilly missing the forest for the trees, I suppose. Not that we're at all surprised. This sort of deserves a couple of minutes of our time, I think. I hope. It would be nice. I guess it's not going to... Oh, well, never mind. At any rate, O'Reilly said that NBC will not cover the murders in Arkansas because they're not much interested in the truth. Brian Williams is a big problem here as managing editor of the Nightly News. He allowed a correspondent to highlight me as a villain in the Tiller situation. Williams takes his orders directly from NBC President Jeff Zucker, a committed liberal, who has completely ruined the news operation, turning it into the most far-left outfit in the history of broadcasting. Jesus, you'd think he was talking about Pravda or TASS. Far-left. Come on, Bill. Just say the word you're thinking of. And that goes, you know, in a way that sort of proves the illegitimacy of the right-wing's argument. People like the filthy Bill. Falafel Bill, I mean. Can't use the word they're thinking of. Can't use the word they really want to because they know they would be caught immediately. Because there's a lot of people in this country who just don't, not much interested in red baiting anymore. So, Falafel Bill has to say things like, a far left news organization. When what he's really talking about, what he really wants to say, commies! They're commies! They're all commies! Pink old commies with hammers and sickles tattooed on their little butt. They're commies, I tell you! Yeah. You know that. Yeah, his attempt to cover his butt went so far as to, well, never mind. You know what to expect from Falafel Bill. Lies, lies, more lies. Because, as we say here in the hills, the truth ain't in him. But along the same lines, I mentioned a minute ago what the for-profit media have proven very not good at sharing. It turns out, and you might find this interesting, it turns out that the United States government, the United States military, namely the Pentagon, has finally gotten around to fessing up about what happened recently and over the course of the recent past in Afghanistan. A U.S. military investigation has reached the conclusion that massive civilian casualties, scores of villagers in the last month alone in Afghanistan, those slaughters took place because our military failed to follow very strict rules that were devised to prevent civilian casualties there. This is out of the Guardian and refers to a New York Times article. Four raids in May. One plane was cleared to attack Taliban fighters, then it had to circle back and didn't reconfirm the target before it dropped its payload. Then there's another story in which a compound that was said to be housing militants who were massing for a possible counterattack. Well, the thing was struck in violation of rules that require a more imminent threat to justify putting homes at risk. Here's a quote from the report, or from the anonymous official speaking to the New York Times. In several instances where there was a legitimate threat, the choice of how to deal with that threat did not comply with the standing rules of engagement. I think you can translate that as, oh, hell, bomb them, they're brown anyway. According to Pentagon figures, about 140 civilians were slaughtered in the western province of Farah a month ago. Some of the worst instances of civilian slaughter since we started slaughtering Afghanistan back in, what, 2001? Is that when the bombing started? Like October 2001? Yeah. So I guess we will send a Laurel and Hardy handshake to orphans and widows and widowers, saying, sorry, we've got rules. We didn't follow them. Here's a year's supply of rice-a-roni as your dearly departed parting gift. Enjoy! Lord God. Yeah. You know, that whole learn from your mistakes thing, that's a big part of being human, isn't it? Meanwhile, I suppose all the big talk today is centered on President Barack Obama's conversation with the Muslim world that was manifested today in a speech in Cairo, talking about a new beginning for the relationship between the Islamic world and America, the United States. See, Mexico and Canada are part of America, too, so that monolithic, we're the United States of America. That's why that preposition's there, but never mind. It is being said, this from Agence France-Presse, in what may be a defining moment of his presidency, Obama laid out a new blueprint for U.S. Middle East policy, vowing to end mistrust, forge a Palestinian state, and defuse a nuclear showdown with Iran. It would be good to defuse that, because right now a nuclear showdown with Iran would involve an Iran that doesn't have any nuclears to show down with. And no real evidence that they intend to have any either. See how easy it is to fall into the prepared traps? A nuclear showdown with Iran. Da-da-da! Only problem? I mean, it's like high noon. And the killers are coming to town, and the sheriff ain't got no gun. Because in that whole nuclear showdown with Iran thing, don't tell anybody, but we're kind of the bad guys. I mean, we're the United States. We're the only people ever to have dropped atomic devices on brown people. You know what I mean, I think. And we're having a nuclear show, talking about nuclear showdowns with people who don't have any nukes. But anyway, that was part of the promise made by President Obama. He said, so long as our relationship is defined by our differences, we will empower those who sow hatred rather than peace. Very true. Very, very true. And among other things, he said also, I have come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world. And apparently it went around the world on television. The cycle of suspicion and discord must end. President Obama said, we will oppose negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear. However, he called upon the Islamic world to apply the same to the United States of America. And also, to become more open in terms of the rights of female human beings and issues touching upon concepts of democracy. At one point, of course, he did the usual thing and had to refer to the fact that Islam and Judaism and Christianity all stem from the same monotheism. And that's always a little bit disheartening. I mean, I know what he can't say, but as someone who rejects at least the vision of a great big white, bearded, juvenile delinquent in the sky who runs around smiting people who haven't done anything to get themselves smitten for. Pandering to that concept is, it's just icky. And interestingly, And this is not going to play well at all in some corners. He said, America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspiration for dignity, opportunity, and a state of their own. He said, the United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements. Uh-oh. This construction violates previous agreements and undermines efforts to achieve peace. It is time for these settlements to stop. Note to Barack Obama, stay off small aircraft. I have a feeling that the Israeli government's knickers are all in a twist tonight and into tomorrow. Because it's, well, it's just not supposed to happen that way. We're supposed to give no, just stay away from the issue. Stay away. Also coming up, I hope, in the next few minutes, a conversation regarding some court action that took place here in the last couple of days here in Wild Wonderful. Regarding some rulings in Raleigh County Circuit Court. Apparently, the First Amendment does not, but you might be interested to know this, the First Amendment does not apply in Raleigh County, West Virginia. No, it doesn't. I give you an example, and we will give you an example. Well, okay, here's the background facts. In the course of these stirring protests that have been taking place, calling much wider attention to the horrors, the ecological and human rights horrors that take place in the Coal River Valley and the southern coal fields of West Virginia relating to mountaintop removal, those protests have been documented by journalists. You know, journalists. Real, live, honest-to-God journalists. Some are photojournalists, some shoot photos and write, some shoot video. And Judge Robert Burnside in Raleigh County, West Virginia, has decided that freedom of the press doesn't exist in his jurisdiction because he has continued an injunction against journalists covering the protests. Really. Now, imagine, if you will, Bull Connor turning loose the hoses and dogs on journalists trying to document what was going on in Birmingham, Alabama, during the civil rights struggle. Imagine, if you will, the people marching to the Edmund Pettus Bridge and the journalists documenting them. Imagine those journalists being enjoined from exercising their First Amendment rights. It just doesn't jibe, does it? But that's what's going on here in West Virginia. And I think this may be maybe the call that I've been expecting. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good to be here, Bob.
Is this Tom?
No, this is Mike Rozelle.
Hey, Mike. Okay, I wasn't sure who was going to be ringing in. Mike Rozelle, Climate Ground Zero. I'm glad you could ring in because, I already got I've given a little bit of background out. I have asserted, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, Mike. I've asserted that Judge Robert Burnside apparently thinks that the First Amendment does not apply to Raleigh County.
Well, the problem here in West Virginia is the judges don't think that any of the federal laws apply in West Virginia. I'm not surprised about that at all.
Well, not surprised, but it's still a little bit saddening, isn't it?
Well, it is. I think it's actually outrage if you think this is a country of laws, and, you know, they twist the laws here to mean whatever they want to mean, and, you know, the most egregious example of that is the fact that mountaintop removal continues, even though it was specifically made illegal unless there were certain loopholes. But I think this is part and parcel, you know, with the assault on free speech rights in West Virginia, because the only reason it can happen is because outside of West Virginia, nobody pays much attention to this. And inside West Virginia, they control the media, and they control the politics, and they control the courts.
With very with a few limited exceptions, you're absolutely right. I believe we've got another witness to all of this on the line. Let's check in and see. Hey, welcome to the program.
Tom Rist.
Hey, is that Tom?
It is.
Tom Rist, thank you for joining. I've got Mike Rozelle on the other line. Now, just getting the discussion started about what went on in the courtroom here in the last few days. Could you give us a brief synopsis, please?
Well, we didn't get what we were looking for, did we, Mike?
No, we didn't.
We were looking at a preliminary injunction. The lawyers from Massey had asked for. And they were trying, basically what it is we're in a civil case. In a civil case, a party can ask for a preliminary injunction, which prevents the other party from doing something until the case is resolved. All right, so in this case, what they were asking for was everybody to stop protesting, basically, and coming on their property and protesting mountaintop removal. And we were fighting that tooth and nail, and the ruling that came down from the court, we don't have the written order yet, but basically the preliminary injunction prevents the named parties from doing any of that in the future. It wasn't a total loss, though. There were some things in there. I mean, the way the proposed order was drafted, the attorneys for Massey actually had it set up so if a journalist or someone came on the property, the state police were ordered to search them, take anything in their possession, basically turn it over to the attorneys for Massey.
Dear God!
Strange.
And they didn't get away with that? Tell me they didn't get away with that.
No, we didn't even have to argue about that. The judge basically went through and crossed out a lot of that stuff. But what we were hoping to do was to get Mike up there talking about a lot of the problems that are happening down there. And really, our defense to the entire thing, it was that this is a necessity. We have to do something about it.
And that was forestalled?
It was. It was. The judge wouldn't hear any of that. Yeah, I'll tell you what was really interesting about the hearing. You know, I'm in there helping out Roger Foreman, and Roger's a phenomenal attorney. I've had cases against him. We're fortunate to work on this. And then Professor Bob Basters from the WU Law School was representing another photojournalist as well as Jody Wu. And so you've got a couple of really good attorneys sitting in the room. And then you have Mike, who about, I don't know, hour or two into one of the hearings, decided to represent himself. And of everyone that we tried to get on the stand to talk and do whatever, Mike did the best job of getting up there and really getting the attention of the court as to what was going on. And I think Mike can talk about that better, but he got shut down by the court as well.
Well, Mike, what were you in? What did you want to be the thrust of your message to the court and by extension to the people?
Well, it was a pretty simple message. Massey was involved in illegal activity in Clay Branch, which is one of the places where our protests took place. And that Bo had complained repeatedly to all the authorities, gone to Washington, D.C., had done everything that an American citizen could possibly do to remedy the problem, and he got nowhere. He got a bunch of gobbledygook from the lawyers, and you're very familiar with it. I've seen you in many of these hearings. So he had no other recourse. Of course, he was not the one that resorted to this. But this, you know, an injury to one is an injury to all. And, you know, we all depend on the ecological services of the Appalachians, whether we know it or not. And this was a clear-cut case of necessity. Now, necessity, you know, speaks to, like, justifiable homicide, when you may accidentally take someone's life to prevent them from killing a member of your family. So this is a very well-established legal recourse that people have. And, you know, it would be one thing to say that it was not relevant to the trespass case, but this is really what irritated me, is both Massey's lawyers and the judge, you know, were referring to civil disobedience, and to say that our protest could not possibly have any effect, that they were just for publicity, that Massey's activity was indeed legal, whether we like it or not, and that we were just frustrated because, having gone through all the checks and balances that we were offered, that we didn't get the result that we wanted, so that we decided to rise above the law, take the law into our own hand, and engage in protest. And I stated from the beginning that this is really not about protest. This here is about intervening in a very serious crime. And we, if we were allowed to offer testimony, we could have proven not only was there lawbreaking going on up on Clay Branch, but that our actions had stopped it, because guess what? There has not been any blasting on Clay's Branch since our action. The reason? Bo went to the Washington, D.C. office of the EPA in person. He talked to the people there. They had heard about the protest. And they are the ones who issued the citations.
I suspect that a lot more people have heard about the protest than what Judge Burnside may think, and what the Massey lawyers may wish. And it's worth noting at the front end of all of this, while you, Mike, you've talked about the defense of necessity in terms of home defense or the justifiable homicide for a home invader, something like that, these are all nonviolent protests.
Absolutely, and we've been very clear with that. All the literature that we put out has a nonviolent agreement that everyone must accept. We insist that they go through a nonviolence preparation, and where this can be discussed and agreed upon and understood. And you know, even the West Virginia media has repeatedly referred to this as a peaceful protest. And yet they keep trying to portray our actions as aggressive, as belligerent, as dangerous, as careless. They use words like willy-nilly, running roughshod, guerrilla warfare, and, of course, jihad to describe...
Jihad?
Yeah, well, they have been calling us all sorts of names in court. And so it's just dishonest, and they know better. The judge knew better, but yet Massey and the judge made repeated comments that there was no comparison. In fact, the judge said he was insulted when Roger Foreman made the comparison between Martin Luther King's struggle against legal segregation in the Deep South and the struggle that we're waging here against mountaintop removal. And, you know, that's well and good for him to have that opinion, but...
Well, did he give any idea? Well, I got
to offer our testimony.
I got to ask you, Mike. Did he give any indication of what it was that insulted him about it?
Well, obviously, he thinks that we're not deserving of that sort of a comparison, and but yet he would not let us offer any testimony to show that there were indeed comparisons, not only with that, but with the Dred Scott decision and the Geneva Convention, the Nuremberg Principles, and international law, common law. These are well-grounded legal principles, and they come into play in our system, you know, not in novel ways, but in very important ways. And we were denied any ability to offer evidence in front of a judge. We didn't even have a jury, as if this would be somehow prejudicial, as if he didn't already know this. And we think there are some striking comparisons. And there would have been no harm to Massey or to the court for us to be able to put Bo Webb on the stand and explain that this was our only recourse, this was a successful recourse, and because of our actions, there has been no more illegal activity, that is, blasting of the mountain up above his house since the day of our demonstration. So these are facts in the case. They're not theories. And they are matters of law, they're matters of record, And we should have been able to present that evidence. That's all we asked for.
Tom, let me ask you, within the legal framework that you have to work with, when you're dealing with something like a question of whether to enjoin conduct, is the potential enjoinee not allowed to explain why they did what they did?
Well, we thought that should be what we were allowed to do. And you can hear the frustration from Mike as he talks about that hearing. And what they do and what the legal really rule that we look at in a preliminary injunction is a balancing of the harms. The harm done to the plaintiff versus the harm to the defendant. And I think our biggest problem maybe was just that the court just didn't see how there could be any harm to the defendants in keeping them away from these properties. And, you know, to the contrary, there's lots of harm. The reason they're down there, the reason that these protests happen is because of all the harm that's happening
precisely
to the mountains in West Virginia. And that was the evidence that Mike wanted to put on. We tried on several occasions through different means to get that evidence on. We tried to call Bo Webb to the stand, and I think Bo barely got his name out before the lawyers for Massey were objecting. They obviously know who Bo is. And it frustrated us a bit. It really did.
I can well imagine what you're describing to me, Tom, sounds like a situation where, to raise that civil rights analogy again, to say, well, Dr. King, you don't need to be in Birmingham. You don't need to be on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in order to protest. Is it a similar situation?
Absolutely. And if you look at the history of the anti-segregation movement, you find that the proponents of segregation used all of these arguments. Martin Luther King was an outsider in Alabama. He was from Atlanta. He had backing from out-of-state people. He was supporting anarchy. He thought he was above the law. He didn't take advantage of other means that were available to him to address this injustice. And the list goes on.
So, and that history also extends back into West Virginia's history as well, if I recall correctly. One of the primary tools during the earliest labor struggles in the coal fields was the mine companies doing exactly what Massey has done today and seeking injunctions against people organizing organizing for better labor conditions, for better pay, better work environments. It seems like everything old is new again. Tom, what about the First Amendment aspect of this? What of the journalists who were enjoined?
Well, the court really wasn't looking at that issue, I think, as much as what we wanted them to. I mean, obviously, that's very obvious, but Professor Bastris from WVU Law School, his client, Chad Stevens, is making a documentary about the Coal River Wind project that the
right
folks down there were trying to put together as an alternative to this kind of short-term bang for the buck, get in and out and not worry about what it looks like afterwards approach. And so he went in and filmed some protesters who had chained themselves to a backhoe or a piece of equipment or something on a road. They said they were, I think one of the guys that testified in there said they were building a road at the time. And so Chad wasn't ever stopped by the police. On the way up to the spot where he was chained in, he saw no trespassing sign. They went through the woods, through the mountains, up four-wheeler trails and things. Didn't see any signs. Goes out. They chain themselves up. And I guess Chad films all this. And this was the testimony I heard. Obviously, I don't know much more about it. But apparently, when the police showed up, they you know, see some folks chained to the dozer or backhoe or whatever it is there. And Chad filming. And the policeman said something to the effect of, you do your job, I'll do mine, after Chad explained why he was there. He was just filming. He never even got a citation for anything. He actually rode down out of the mine site, or off this road where they were, with the policeman. Goes down to the barracks down there and gets his camera set up again to film the folks coming out. And I guess at some point, one of the Massey guys, a security guy or a safety guy, says, you know, aren't you coming in here? And so he ends up getting a ticket for trespassing. And that, that was one of the people we were dealing with.
As I remember, Tom, Chad voluntarily accepted the citation. And this is the core of this issue, I think. We were charged with simple trespass. Maximum fine of $100. No threat of jail. And what the Massey lawsuit is alleging is obstruction. Well, we were never arrested for obstruction. If they wanted to arrest us for obstruction, they should have. They never asked for any financial damages that would have been associated with obstruction, and they tried to play it down when the media called them that they were just arrested for simple trespass. Chad was willing to risk arrest for simple trespass in order to get the story. But in no way was he involved in the protest. In no way would he have obstructed. He was covering it.
And Mike, he was, and Antrim as well, also another journalist involved with this. They were performing the functions of journalists, if I understand correctly.
Absolutely, and professionally, and in a very open way, including wearing their credentials and identifying themselves to Massey Security and the state police when they arrived as journalists. And they were indeed accepted and recognized as journalists during this part of this action. And it wasn't only when they came back later with the tort claim that they said, well, we were obstructing. Well, why didn't they say we were obstructing when the Gazette called and said, what were they doing up there? They tried to dismiss it as simple trespass when, in fact, there was an active intervention in a blasting, a very dangerous proposition, and a successful one. And in all of our actions, blasting was shut down for the day. It didn't occur. They took the machines off the mountain. They took the blasting crews off the mountain. And I think it's kind of like a NASA launch. You know, once they go off their schedule, they can't go back. And so that goes to our effectiveness. But the journalists were just there to cover that. They weren't there to take part in that.
And they didn't take part. They didn't. Neither of the journalists held a banner. None of them
may not be guilty of trespass. That's not the question here. But they're willing to face the charges of trespass. But what they're being charged with is obstruction and taking action against Massey when they were, in effect, neutral parties, journalists, doing their job. So, I mean, there is some allowances for journalists to trespass in certain cases.
Well, I seem to remember seeing photographs from the march on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And I don't think those were taken by idle passers-by. Those were the work of journalists, right?
They chose not to arrest the journalists who trespassed on the bridge.
That's always been my understanding. Tom, what is the nature of the harm that Massey is alleging in this? I mean, are they alleging that somebody hurt the money?
Well, that was an issue we got into. And one thing to remember with the journalists, as well as something that's important, is that their presence also protects the people protesting. Because, no one at the mine sites, my understanding, has been anything but polite to everyone there. They've actually been quite cordial. But should there be someone that takes this the wrong way, the journalists and someone standing there with a camera, it's much less likely anything bad would happen. There's actually an area of protection that's involved there. Tell me your question.
I appreciate the follow-up, Tom. My question was, with regard to this injunction, what is the nature of the harm which Massey alleges is happening? Because, and I'll tell you why I ask you that, coal is a finite resource, but it is not an instantaneously diminishing one. It's gonna stay there in the ground for a while. As such, how do they think that they're being harmed by these protests?
Well, Bob, you and I know what the harm to Massey is. They do not want any attention to their activities, and they do not want us to awaken the consciousness of America and their outrage against it. So that's what the harm is. That's not the harm they're alleging in court. What they are saying is that these journalists were part of the protest, and therefore they caused harm, as the protesters did. But, you know, Tom is absolutely right. One of the reasons we were very keen on having journalists with us is we thought that that not only increased our safety, but that the chance of anything happening and everyone's safety. And I mean, I'm not sure if we're that's a good legal argument, but from a practical standpoint, we did not want anything to escalate. The presence of cameras tend to keep people from misbehaving. So that is a very crucial aspect to why we wanted the journalists there. Also, we are trying to awaken the consciousness of this country so that they can bring the necessary political pressure to end mountaintop removal. That's the harm that Massey is afraid of, but it is not the one that they are raising in court.
Exactly.
The other thing that Mike brought up that was really interesting in court, he did it, I think, during a cross-examination of one of these witnesses, he took a picture of himself that the Massey lawyer had brought in evidence, and walks up there and shows it to the guy and asks him, you know, what's this big dump truck? And when I say dump truck, it's these huge, massive trucks that carry 100 tons plus of coal.
Yeah, the tires themselves are taller than a human being.
Right. And in the background, Mike pointed out to the guy, because they're saying, oh, you know, we have all these damages. We had to stop mining coal. We've got a couple thousand acre site, and in the background of this picture, there's actually a dump truck that with the back part of it up in the air, and there's Mike standing there, and there's a dump truck, you know, dumping rock, and they're still working, I guess, in the background. But those are the damages issues we've never really gotten to.
Yeah, those will come up eventually, and the fact is that it's a very big, open, flat pit, like a strip mine normally is, and if you've got two or three protesters, which is all we normally had, some of our groups have been a little bit larger, that they can work around you. And that's exactly what they did. And so when we get to the damage phase, we can discuss how much mayhem we really caused. In terms of them taking the dynamite crews off the mountain, that'll be another question for us to discuss. But it was exactly those dynamite crews that are involved in the most egregious harm aspect, and we're not afraid to meet that one head on. And I'm personally proud of the fact that those drivers got in those trucks and drove and didn't do a blast that day. But that was their decision. We weren't anywhere near there, and they could have gone ahead and blasted anyway. It was their belief that there was more of us around, and at that point they were becoming quite excited and maybe even a little bit paranoid. And they were saying they saw protesters here and protesters there on the ridge in the woods. And honestly, there was just myself and James McGinnis and one photographer on the site, on the entire site. So I don't know how we can be directly blamed for that, because we weren't in the blasting zone that had to be cleared. But you know, anyway, this damage phase will be very interesting, but we're not going to pay the damages. So I don't know how it matters to us, and we don't have the money anyway.
Well, I guess I'm being a little bit the damages issue is simply bothersome to me, because I can't see where any are.
No, absolutely.
Thomas, do you anticipate that they will have some degree of difficulty proving damages?
Well, the work stoppage, if there was any, and there probably was a certain amount, were less than an hour and a half in the longest case, I think. And we're not very far from the state police office, and they know their way up that road. And once they're called, it's just a matter of time before the demonstration is over. So we're not talking about long periods of time here in most cases. And, you know, it's just if you work on a mine like that, there are lots of reasons why you might shut down. There might be weather. There might be labor problems. People showing up or not showing up. There might be a strike or something. But in all those instances, you wouldn't file a tort claim. So it really seems like their lawyers are just trying to hit us with a sledgehammer, trying to deter us in this way. And I was very clear with the judge. I said, one of the requirements of getting this injunction is that it actually would deter. And I made it very clear to him that it would not. And to me, that was my main argument, that it should be denied, because it has to be a reasonable request. And if it's not going to deter, then why bother? And there's a criminal court to deal with this. That's where it should be dealt with. We're not afraid of the criminal courts. We're not afraid to take responsibility for our action. We're not trying to say that under normal circumstances this wouldn't be illegal. We're trying to say that the circumstances are not normal.
That they are, in fact, extraordinary.
Exactly. Mike, would you explain to someone testified during that hearing that basically, even when you guys showed up, that a couple of cars go by, a minor stops, says hi, keeps going up the road to go get coffee. I mean, it's not like they're, you know, these three people walk out onto a 2,000 plus acre site and everything shuts down.
Right. No, there were moments when, you know, we were just walking down the road, and the trucks were passing us. The excavators were working. Everybody was, you know, doing whatever they were doing. And you know, they knew who we were. We knew who they were. There wasn't any confusion there. There certainly wasn't any danger. There was all kind of people walking around on the mine site. And we weren't behaving any differently than any of these other people might have been in terms of putting anyone at risk. But when we decided to step out in the road, you know, it is ultimately a very symbolic act. I mean, two people cannot shut down a large strip mine by themselves. It's impossible. They have to shut it down themselves. And that was based on just their perception of what they might have thought the threat was. But, they cannot say that we were any threat to their ability to remove coal from the mountain. And but this is, you know, in a way an aside, because we want them to stop. And
once and for all, yes,
the whole thing, and we could have stayed there for a month. That would have been preferable.
I understand that, and at some point,
got the enthusiasm for it,
without a doubt. So Tom, this is actually the trial phase of this injunction. You're trying it to the court without a jury? Is that where you are procedurally?
Well, remember, the injunction is just a part of what they did when they filed the lawsuit. There's a civil complaint, just like any other case. They've sued Mike. They've sued the other protesters. They've sued the two journalists for monetary damages. The one thing they've asked for, and this gets back to the First Amendment issue and the photojournalist, one thing that Antrim Caskey and three others were held in contempt of a prior temporary restraining order. That's the first thing the court gets. You file a suit, and you can basically walk into the judge's chamber with this order saying, we want to restrain these people. You don't do it with other parties there. And the judges usually grant those. They do look through them before signing off on them. But that's kind of what happens before we get to the hearing we just did. Okay, so this temporary restraining order is in place while we wait for the hearing on the preliminary injunction. That's to provide protection to that party asking for it. So some of the people, after that temporary restraining order had been issued, did some of these protests, and the judge found four of them in contempt. They did not find Mike in contempt. He was cleared of that. And as a result of that hearing, I saw an affidavit in there for attorney's fees of $19,000. That they're asking for from the people held in contempt.
You almost think that it sounds to me like it's financially imprudent for Massey to be even pursuing this. $19,000? What have those guys done so far? What kind of hourly rate is that?
I just want to say that there actually is something ironic about me being found not guilty of contempt.
Yes. Well, it is. I think I get your meaning.
Contempt for this process. We went in there with an open mind. We actually thought Judge Burnside, who has a reputation for being a pretty close adherent to the law, sometimes taking a very narrow vision of it, but we expected him to be fair and unbiased, and I think we found otherwise. And but had this been a fair proceeding, had we been allowed to present our evidence, we would have felt much better regardless of what the verdict was.
Obviously there's a record being made, Tom. Will this process continue to an appellate phase once the entire trial phase is done?
Well, we think that where we stand right now, there are some issues that are already appealable that we might go ahead and take up. One of them is the issue on the temporary restraining order, and you know, I'll be candid with you. The court was looking at the law and interpreted the law as close to it as it could. I've done a lot of work in front of Judge Burnside, and while this didn't come down the way we wanted it to, he just, you know, said, look, the law's here, this is what we're going to do. He wouldn't hear any of our necessity defense, because in a situation like that, there's nothing in West Virginia, there's no case to look at that says you've got the ability to do this. And the only way that a case like that gets established is you take the facts we have and you go to the next court, to the Supreme Court, to try to get it established. And sometimes the trial court judge can be tied, his hands can be tied, by the case law. At times I did think the judge was quite sympathetic and actually complimentary to some of the folks that were involved there. It's just that the law on the books, it doesn't support the necessity defense.
And that's not surprising to see that be the case in West Virginia, in light of the state's history.
And we see that, but we think it's wrong, and we're going to try to do the best we can to get some different law on the books that way. I mean, there's two ways to get law. One of them is through the legislature, and Mike and Bo Webb and the people that are down on the Coal River can talk to you about how far that's gotten. And then the other way is to go through the court system. A court can make law, case law, and this is a situation. Roger and I think that maybe we've got an opportunity here.
And given that fact, what kind of a time frame are you working with, Tom? How long will this trial court phase last? When do you go back?
I get asked that by a lot of clients, and I wish I had answers to those. You can a civil action can go. It seems like sometimes for years it really can without being resolved. And candidly, I'm not sure that after the preliminary injunction being entered, what more the attorneys for Massey really want to do with the case, unless they're really going to push to try to get damages. And so how long it's going to take or where the case is going to go is anyone's guess. But I do think we've had some rulings that we might be able to go ahead and take up here in the near future.
So you don't necessarily have to see all of the civil action all the way through to its conclusion before you get some issues that can go up. Do I understand you correctly?
That's correct. That can happen in a couple of different ways. And you can ask the court to certify questions to the Supreme Court. There are ways to do it without waiting for the entire case to end. You have to have kind of some finality to an order issued by the court. And one thing we have that is sitting here is we had on file, Roger had moved to set aside the temporary restraining order because it was really overbroad. Really overbroad.
It was
President Obama came down to the Coal River and walked over there to say hi and see what was going on. He would have been in contempt. I mean, it just applied to anyone that showed up down there almost.
I remember reading the reportage on it, and it did seem that exchange where the judge said, "Well, it applies to everybody." I thought, "Wow, where did you get jurisdiction to do that?"
Well, and remember the temporary restraining order that gets entered was drafted by the lawyers for Massey. They bring
sure.
it into the court, and so it's going to be drafted in a way that maybe it is overbroad.
It's a wish list.
You know, The court has to take what is presented to it at face value. And as long as it's, you know, not something that you can look at and just determine, hey, you know, this is just wrong, and it looks like there's a foundation for it based on the allegations and the complaint, they can issue a temporary restraining order. And so the people that were found in contempt, we've got issues with that that we think could be brought up because they've been fined $500 apiece, including Antrim Caskey, the photojournalist.
I was going to ask you, do those First Amendment issues present a case of jurisdiction for the federal courts in this state?
Well, it may be something. I mean, the First Amendment law, most of the cases on that, you're getting that from the Supreme Court. And that's something that, you know, if Professor Bastris was on here, he could cite to you, you know, lots of cases on that issue. And I thought he had a real good argument that he made on that First Amendment issue, with there being a privilege for the freedom of the press to be able to do this type of thing and film this type of action when they're not partaking in it. But the problem was it was just a simple trespass charge. And so the person's on the property, the court just comes to the conclusion, okay, you're trespassing. And in Antrim Caskey's case, she's what would be referred to as an embedded journalist. And she's trying to get this information and trying to get the word out by being inside of and watching this. She's not a protester, though.
No, I mean, she's not carrying, neither she nor Chad are carrying any banners, chanting any slogans, anything that would indicate that they are anything but objective journalists creating a record. I mean, is that a fair characterization?
That's absolutely correct.
So I realize the process itself is drawn out, and you don't know where an end is. But do you know when you go back the next time?
Well, we've got some of the criminal cases have become a bit of an issue because some of the folks spent some time in jail on a non-jailable offense.
Well, I didn't know if you would be prepared to address those, Tom. If you are, I would appreciate it if you could. Because when the news broke about that, I must admit, I was rather stunned at $2,000 cash bails. Is that correct?
That's right. And that's something we take issue with. And then I can't discuss a whole lot what we're looking at in those cases because a lot of them are pending.
Right, I understand.
What I can tell you is that in West Virginia, my take on it, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'm a lawyer in West Virginia, so... What I see is that the West Virginia Code, it's 50-2-3. There's a limitation on bail in West Virginia. And that's that in cases punishable only by the fine. I've got it sitting here. I've had this case on my desk. It won't get off my desk. In cases punishable only by the fine, such bail or recognizance shall not exceed the maximum amount of the fine cost permitted by statute. And so in a case like that, like what Mike was charged with, a simple trespass, that's what everybody was charged with.
$100, right?
Fine. Court costs here are about $165. And so let's say the top with my bad math is $300, right?
All right.
Let's give some room there. That's where bail should have been set. And when that happened,
I think
actually,
you're overcharging for court costs.
Well,
given the quality of justice we're getting,
I don't think you can pay only for what you think is the good justice. But with the cases that occurred and what happened with there were seven of them, I think. Is that right, Mike?
Yes.
And they're trespass and some littering, do I understand?
Well, the littering charge was for the folks who took the boat out onto the sludge pond with the banner, and the banner was the litter, not the toxic sludge underneath.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the irony is not lost on me.
That's kind of like you taking some trash and sticking it in your neighbor's trash can and then getting charged with littering.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so even under those circumstances, potential bail there's not $2,000. I mean, I've driven by the signs on the side of the road. Littering, punishable by law, maximum penalty, $1,000.
Right. Yeah, the two women who were on the sludge pond didn't get out till Tuesday morning. And actually, Judge Burnside reduced their bail to a personal recognizance bond. So I think that speaks to the outrageousness of this bail, and I think it only happened because it was on Memorial Day weekend. And I think if better minds had been in charge, this may not have happened. But I think there are some.
Well, most of the arrests have also taken place, or many of the arrests have taken place in Boone County as opposed to Raleigh, have they not?
Well, we had seven arrested in Boone County.
And they were booked and photographed and printed and released, right?
Conspiracy and trespass in the second degree, which carries a 6 months jail sentence. So we have a little bit different situation up there. There's been no civil action. It was Arch Coal, a different coal company, and a different county where Burnside doesn't have any jurisdiction. And Massey wasn't involved, so their attorneys were not involved. We're still awaiting the outcome of that. They're facing some fairly serious charges here, even though they were released without bail. So bail is not the only issue here, but in this particular case, this was just totally uncalled for, and it seemed vindictive, and we are nonviolent protesters. We have been treated in a certain way by the state police, and we think that that way has been good, that we are cited, that we get to appear in court, we get to take responsibility for the actions that we take, and we answer for them. And, this was just a way to try to have punitive damages on us, even though we were still innocent under law. We hadn't been convicted.
Tom, does some of this represent an attempt to... processes, either philosophically or jurisprudentially, are they designed to stop the protests themselves from recurring?
Are you talking about the extraordinarily high bonds that were set?
Among other things, yes.
Well, that one I don't have an answer for. And I think that's something that we're going to probably end up having to challenge now, because some people spent some time in jail, but. There is a history with civil disobedience type cases where the companies who always have more money than any protesters or anyone meaning to do good for the cause they represent are ever going to be able to spend. And those companies can chill the protests by getting their lawyers in there, letting them loose in the courtroom. On the people who many times aren't represented by anyone, and that's been a way historically to stop this type of thing from happening.
Well, don't I recall Mother Jones being penned up as a result of similar action back in the early 20th century? Wasn't she penned up in Clarksburg or somewhere?
I don't know if it was in Clarksburg, but I actually looked that up yesterday because someone had asked me. They said something about people not being from West Virginia that are protesting, and I thought, well, wait a second, everybody's going to hug Mother Jones and say, that's the miner's mother.
Angel of the coal fields.
That's it. Yeah, and she's from Ireland. Then lived in, I think, Chicago and Tennessee. She wasn't from West Virginia, but she did so much to help us. And so I was looking at that. She actually had a preliminary injunction granted against her, just like what's happened here. She violated it, ended up in jail, had some other issues. And kind of the short story of it was she was eventually released because of the public outcry about it.
And along the way, similar to some of the slurs and slanders and libels that have been published about Mike, along the way, Mother Jones was referred to as the most dangerous woman in America.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, guys, I appreciate the time that you have taken with us this evening. Mike, I hope you will keep us updated. Tom, I appreciate you for involving yourself in these cases. I remember the words of Justice Holmes, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. He said somewhere along the way, it is possible to live greatly in the law. And I would hope and I would suspect that this effort that you have undertaken will be, when you look back at a long and fruitful career, one of those moments when you have lived greatly in the law.
I really appreciate that. I'm going to pass that on to Roger Foreman, too, who's, you know, his efforts have been greater than mine. He's just helping me get my feet in the door on helping out with things like this. So I do appreciate that. And, Mike, I look forward to chatting with you and moving forward, buddy.
Absolutely. And if you want to keep up, Bob, on our campaign, you know, you just go to climateground0.org. And we try to do the best we can to keep everyone updated.
And I hope that you will both access the horn as a means of reaching thousands of people around the planet and keeping them abreast of this, because one of the most important things that can come out of this is that one of the reasons that this is all taking place is because mountaintop removal is not a local issue. Mountaintop removal is not an Appalachian issue. Mountaintop removal may not even just be an American issue. It is, in fact, a global issue. And y'all are doing, from the legal standpoint, Tom, and from the on-the-ground standpoint, Mike, you're both doing God's work as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And both of you have a great evening. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
We will.
Bye now. Mike Rozelle, Climate Ground Zero. Tom Rist, counsel. I think you get an idea why I keep talking to you about the heroism of everyone involved in this struggle. Because, see, when you're getting a few thousand dollars a month to go to work for the coal company and destroy something millions of years in the making, well, you know what? That's why you're doing it. You're getting paid for it, getting a nice living out of it. But when you act on your morals, and when you act on the convictions of your character, upon the ethics that motivate your daily living, well, then you're doing something heroic. And you are doing something, in fact, superhuman. You are doing something extraordinary. And every last person, no matter what they do in the fight against mountaintop removal, is creating for themselves a life history that says, while I was here, I did more than just pass the time of day. I took it personal, and I made it count. And those kind of energies in the grand scheme of things, I think, probably count the highest. Let's see. It's about 17 minutes past the hour. We're going to take a little break and come back with your thoughts, your phone calls, your ideas, your emails, your participation, your part in recreating the national discussion, the national debate, the international global dialogue about what it means to be us. You will be, in fact, creating, idea by idea, the very essence of what the horn is. What the horn is America's liberal voice, activist radio, and we'll be right back.
Getting up and going down. High to low, looking right to left. If you see us coming, I think it's best to move away. Do you hear what I say? From under my breath. Around. alive. See the boys and me mean business, busting out dead or alive. I can hear the hound dogs on my trail. All hell breaks loose, alarm and sirens wail. Like a game, if you lose, go to jail. Tonight is gonna be a jailbreak.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream.
It's
Coal
Thursday.
River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, June 4, 2009.
Obama moves mountains, unfortunately. Coal State Dems heart coal. And big bellies in Philly.
You know, this week's Rolling Stone has a naked woman on the cover. It's their environmental issue. So today, Desi Doyen will be performing Green News completely naked. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this is your Green News Report.
Well, I'm working in a coal mine, going down, 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 working in a coal mine, whoop, about to spin.
All right, Desi, looking good.
Wow, it's a little cold in here.
Yeah, I can tell. What do you got for us today, Des?
The Obama administration quietly approved 42 out of 48 surface coal mining permits that had previously been halted for review by the Environmental Protection Agency. This was after private meetings between the White House and the coal industry that were set up by congressional Democrats from coal states who argued that denying those permits would result in job losses and higher electricity rates in depressed regions. And critics do point, though, to studies that show that mountaintop removal mining actually employs fewer miners than conventional underground mining.
Right. What are we talking about here? We're talking about blowing the tops of mountains off.
Yes,
right?
And then pushing the rubble into surrounding valleys and streams, which cuts off the water that people live on in those areas.
And it's scarred for life, right?
And it's scarred.
Mountains
well,
are just,
they do have to do a certain amount of backfill, but there are indications that there is no enforcement to ensure that these companies actually do restore the area when they're finished.
Right.
It can never be restored to what it was before.
That's right. So Obama is blowing the tops off of mountains. This is what we would expect, frankly, from the Bush administration. It's incredibly disappointing to see the Obama administration doing it.
Well, the EPA did reject six of those permits over concerns that the projects would harm local water quality. They said the EPA's understanding is that none of the projects would permanently impact high-value streams that flow year-round, except they have yet to define what constitutes a high-value
stream. So they rejected six. How many did they allow?
They allowed 42.
Man.
SolveClimate.org is reporting that Representative Rick Boucher of Virginia inserted a provision into the Waxman-Markey Climate and Energy Bill to create a, quote, carbon storage research corporation that would accelerate the commercial availability of carbon capture and storage techniques, and they will fund it with $10 billion over 10 years, and $500 million of that is earmarked for, quote, administrative expenses to be determined by the officers of the corporation. That $10 billion that's going to be funded for this new carbon research corporation mm-hmm. will be funded by a 50-cent tax added to everyone's electric bill every month.
And this is Rick Boucher.
Nationwide.
Republican, right?
No, he's a Democrat.
Oh, really? From which
yes.
state?
From Virginia.
From Virginia. So $10 billion corporation. Now, in and of itself, carbon capture and research for that is not a bad thing, is it?
It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's definitely something that we should look into because China is going to continue to build coal plants. And the thinking is that if they're going to do it, if we are the ones who figure out this technology, we can then sell it to the Chinese.
The technology of how to capture this these toxic
carbon
global warming gases
and
bury them under the ground.
Yes, it has yet to be determined how to make that commercially viable.
But we're spending $10 billion on it, so it's commercially viable now.
And the tug of war over coal is fought on the state level, too. This Tennessee state legislature was on the verge of passing a law that would have raised the limits on how much toxic selenium that coal companies are allowed to dump into the state rivers, but the measure lost by just one vote in the state house. The Democrat who cast the deciding vote said approval would mean poisoning the state's waters to help a coal company win a lawsuit in which it is accused of illegally dumping toxic selenium into the state's rivers.
So we have a Democrat who actually stood up this time for
yes.
the right thing?
And a follow-up on a story we reported last week about the chemical BPA, that plastics additive that's a known endocrine disruptor. The Bush FDA had declared that BPA was safe over the objections of its own scientists.
Right, used in baby bottles and Bush
sippy cups.
Bush allowed them to poison the babies and hid the study.
Now the Washington Post has obtained notes from a private meeting of plastics manufacturers and their customers, which shows they're trying to devise a PR and lobbying strategy to ease the public concern and head off any attempts to regulate or ban BPA. This is from the article. Quote, their Holy Grail spokesperson would be a pregnant young mother who would be willing to speak around the country about the benefits of BPA.
What are the benefits of BPA? Why do we need BPA? Why do we need it in baby bottles? Even if there's a possibility that it's toxic and it may be poisoning people, why do we need BPA?
The chemical industry wishes to be able to continue to manufacture it.
What does it do?
It makes
what do we need
plastics
BPA?
Harder, and there is actually an alternative that's available in Japan, but I don't know why we're not using it.
But it makes it the bottles harder and pliable and so forth, the plastic?
It makes the bottles harder. The city of Philadelphia is now home to Big Bellies. As part of their ambitious plans to go green, the city's now deployed smart trash bins called the Big Belly, and these trash bins are special. They feature a compactor that is 100% solar-powered, which means the bins can accept five times more trash and therefore don't have to be emptied as often. The city will ultimately deploy 500 of these around the city, and about half of the locations are going to have an attached recycling bin. For the first time, Philly will have street-level recycling in their center area. And city officials say the whole project cuts down on costs associated with constant trash pickup and even in landfill space because recycling costs less than landfill.
Way to go, Philly. Nicely done. Happy about that? Still ticked off about the BPA. Read about all of that and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Goyen.
Put on some clothes. This has been your Green News Report.
I'm about ready to go home, y'all.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do?
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Well, it's been your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox for about 31 minutes now, but who's counting? We're having so much fun, huh? I love the Green News Report a little more every time I hear it. You know, I, too, have done naked radio, but I'm sure it's not as cool as when Desi does it. That's why I love radio. Naked right now! Yeah, sure. One little correction or addendum, if you will. With regard to the whole, well, the Chinese are going to keep, and the Indians are going to keep burning coal, so therefore it's fitting for us to throw $10 billion down the carbon capture rat hole so we can sell it to the Chinese. First of all, I got to just point out that there is no hope whatsoever that $10 billion down that rat hole, see, this is why it's a carbon capture rat hole, will ever yield any technology that can be functionally deployed. One. Two, if we do develop the technology, let me give you an example of how that business of selling it to the Chinese will go. And this isn't this isn't based on some level of speculation. The following are facts. We all know that we would like to see a burgeoning green economy that includes a significant component of green manufacturing in this country. Wind turbines, for instance. 350 tons of steel in a wind turbine, didn't we hear that this past Monday? That could be American steel, manufactured as cleanly and greenly as steel may be made because, you know, it's us doing it. Using the metallurgical coal that is in quickly dwindling supply in Appalachia because it has been put on slow boats to China for so very long to bolster their steel industry and slit the throat of our own. You're such a patriot, Don Blankenship, I just want to vomit. Anyway, we'd like to be making some wind turbines here. Because it's the technology we developed and then the rest of the world deployed because, well, yeah, windmills. Who the hell's going to use windmills? There's no money in windmills. You know, why do we want to make them? Can't we come up with a credit default swap or something instead of making something? You know. But now corporations are talking about making wind turbines. And I think one of the corporations, if I recall my facts correctly, one of the corporations is, in fact, GE. And GE would like to make wind turbines and, what was that phrase, sell it to the Chinese? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you know how the Chinese responded to that idea? We'd love to have GE sell us wind turbines. Love it. Really love it. Great. All of this in, of course, Chinese. And we'd love to have you do it so much that we want to make sure that you do it here. If you want to sell us wind turbines, the wind turbines you're going to sell us are going to be the wind turbines that you manufacture here in China. We don't want no wind turbines manufactured by no Americans getting on no boat like all the metallurgical coal did and coming here. See, you got the coal, and we can't do anything about that, so we'll have to buy it from you because it's there. But you ain't going to manufacture no wind turbines and sell it to us that were made in the United States. No, sunshine, GE. No, you're not going to bring any good things to light if it was made in America. You want to make wind turbines, you make them in China with Chinese workers. Or you ain't gonna sell them to us. All right? With me so far? So let's assume that we throw that some of that $10 billion we throw down the rat hole sticks to the sides and actually we pull something back out of it that we can sell to the Chinese. You know how this goes, right? Hey, we got some carbon capture technology we'd like to sell you. Very good. If you wish to sell us carbon capture technology, you will manufacture the carbon capture technology in China, and you will sell it from China to the rest of the world. You will not manufacture it in the United States of America. Are we clear? Yes, boss! And therefore, that argument out the window again. So don't be, don't be suckered in by that. Yeah, but we can get rich selling them to the Chinese. No. The only people who get rich will be the executives. There won't be anybody doing jobs in America. Because, you see, the People's Republic of China actually protects its labor force and protects its markets. And for all that business about protectionism never works, seems to be working rather well for them. Isn't it? They're just checking. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Alan.
It's Alan.
Yeah.
I was just reading this morning about a company that makes the bearings for windmills.
Uh-huh.
And if I remember correctly from what I read, that they sell their parts to China, and I guess eventually the Chinese would want them to move their factory over to China, and then the Chinese have over 50% of the factory that's over there. And also, I've read about First Solar and Evergreen Solar in this country, and they make solar panels, and I think they sell most of their solar panels in Germany and Japan in the past also. But I rarely see solar panels on houses here.
We have to make them available. We have to make them purchasable.
Yeah.
I mean, if
they give credits in Germany, I think, and to Japan.
Sure.
Tax incentives of sort. And the power company there has to pay them back, I think, for the power, which is at a pretty good rate, too. More so than the rate they pay them back here. Yeah. And the reason I called you about it is I was looking at, on the internet, I was looking at map pictures of mountaintop removal the other day.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a horrible sight. Sometimes I just have to look at it just to see if it's real or not. It's unbelievable what I see in those photos.
It is stunning, and to see it up close firsthand with your own eyeballs makes it an even greater horror.
Yeah, I'm going to have to take that plane trip that you were talking about. you know, where that guy, you could charter a plane. That's
yeah, every time I'm over that way on a clear, sunny day, I see him in his biplane just sort of winging over the area. But I'm sure he wouldn't. Yeah, it's open cockpit, you know, all the fun stuff. I'm sure he wouldn't mind in the least to fly you over the console job that's not too far from his airstrip. Probably not 3 minutes by air.
After I looked at those photos the other day, I called your senators. I called the West Virginia senators, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was ever bit my right to call your senators, even though I'm not from
West
Virginia.
No.
Because I feel like the mountains in West Virginia is a national treasure, and that's what I told them. And that's what I encourage people who are listening to this show right now is to call the senators of West Virginia and tell them what a mess it is, and they need to quit tearing down those mountaintops because we have to have something to enjoy in the future.
Those words are falling on deaf ears at the office of Senator John D. Rockefeller IV. I can tell you that much, Alan.
Yeah, and Robert Byrd also.
Well, among other things, Byrd's been pretty doggone sick lately, but. Yeah, I mean they are completely in the corner of all the destructive extractive industries. They're in the corner of poison. They're in the corner of sludge. They're in the corner of selenium and buried streams and killed wildlife. They're because you know those are the constituencies that have the big money to keep them in office.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, we need to do something. I mean, another thing. Since I travel all around the country, I really need to get a good quality bumper sticker that really has a message about West Virginia mountaintop removal, if I could find one.
You know what? If you could, something as simple as I Love Mountains, because the ilovemountains.org website is a tremendous research tool, information tool, outreach tool for anyone who wants to learn the realities of what mountaintop removal is. Just by way of an example, I was talking with one of the folks that I confabulate with periodically about upcoming books and such like, and I started telling her about I told her about the ilovemountains.org website, and while we were talking, she went to it, plugged in her zip code, and was horrified to realize that every time she turns on her light switch where she lives, she has become part of the process whereby Appalachia is destroyed. And it's when you make it that real for people that that the willingness to do something becomes stronger, because people understand that they are not a passive observer of this, that they are an active participant in it.
Yeah, I've seen bumper stickers that say "I love mountains," so that's what that's about. Huh?
Yeah,
I'd like to see one that just says "Save West Virginia Mountains" or something. I mean, it's something that you need to participate in doing to protect the mountains.
Well, you know, there was one once upon a time. It was a great big billboard, all black, white letters, and it just said "Stop destroying my mountains." And then a little dash, and God.
I saw that bumper. I mean, I saw that big sign. I really like that. It didn't stay up long, did it?
No, not real long.
They need more of those all around West Virginia, all around the country.
Or maybe just a simple bumper sticker that says coal kills.
Yeah. I made one. Remember, I can't remember.
I do. Yeah, Cole's too dirty to be my friend.
Yeah, that'd be pretty good. Figure out how to print that out. Yeah.
And well, then it's a little bit like what Tom was talking about in the last hour. They've always got more money than we do. So you know those bumper stickers become a challenge because it takes money to print them. But we can, you know, I think we can design those things and put them in the horn store.
Yeah,
for people to purchase.
Yeah, and then you can make a profit from it too.
Well, a little bit, not much. but more than anything else.
At least have their organization.
Right, exactly. So maybe we'll get to work on some of that. And you know, bumper stickering is more difficult than initially meets the eye because you got to come up with two or three words that encapsulate an entire idea.
Uh-huh.
You know, coal equals poison is a good one.
Yeah. That's what I like about bumper stickers. They're kind of like poetry. You just got to pack a lot into just a few words.
I think bumper stickers are the American equivalent of haiku.
Yes. That's my favorite poetry too, right there, is haiku.
Me too.
What I remember of it.
And I'm just told that major changes are coming to the Horn store very soon. So,
good.
And you know, you can click on that at the website and go right there, t-shirts, bumper stickers, coffee mugs alike, whatever.
Okay, that'd be great. I hope for the best of that Coal River Mountain Watch, and I like to maybe send them some support pretty soon again, because I think it's such an important organization. It's one of my favorites, and so is yours, your show.
I appreciate that, Alan, and Coal River Mountain Watch, their work has been so vital for so long. And they're at a point where they really do need people's support. And there's a PayPal button there, too.
Well, one of the reasons to protect the mountains in West Virginia is because it's such a beautiful state that you might want to move there someday.
Indeed, you might.
Live up in the mountains like you do.
It's an extraordinary experience. And the more people of conscience and the more people of goodwill who come here, the more likely it is that we will eventually be able to drown out the well-funded voices of the hate-filled coalista right wing. Because I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican. If you're pro coal, you're pretty hard right wing leaning. I'll just say it. There's no such thing as a pro coal liberal. Because the two things are wholly incompatible. They just are.
Yeah. Some people probably claim to be liberals and for coal, but they're kind of talking on both sides of the mouth.
Exactly. Alan, good to hear from you. Where did you say you are?
I'm in Birmingham. I'm about to go to the YMCA and take a swim.
Oh, that'll be nice.
Believe it or not, I drove here from Delaware last night.
Holy cow.
That was a hell of a drive, wasn't it?
Good gracious. You're approaching Burt Reynolds and Jerry Reed status there when you can make that kind of time and over that kind of space. Golly Moses, it probably took me longer to get from D.C. to home on the train than it took you to get from Delaware to Birmingham.
I know. I get to drive more. I don't drive a tractor trailer anymore.
Right.
I don't have to go by those rules that they have for tractor trailers, but it gets kind of rough sometimes. I have to jump around in the seat and stuff to stay awake.
Don't put yourself at hazard.
I want to do that. That's why I told him I need to take a good long break after that load. And that stuff called Red Bull is doesn't work and it's gross. It'll make you sick.
It's toxically sweet and well, I'd probably just spontaneously combust if I drank the stuff. It's nasty.
Yeah, it is. I think you said you like it, don't you?
No, I don't. I can't drink any of those energy drinks. They make it feel like my heart's going to run out of my chest. That's why I don't do caffeine anymore.
Dude, that's the way it is when you get older. You have to mellow out more.
Yeah, I guess so. But, you know, there was so much excitement in D.C. over the last few days. I didn't seem to have any problems staying awake then. So, yeah. It's a good sign for me and my geezerdom.
Yeah. You were interested in things that you really like.
Well, Alan, you take care, and I hope you get a little bit of relaxed time. Go get yourself a nice swim, and we'll look to hear from you again soon.
Okay. All right. And see you later.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Our good buddy Alan the trucker getting some R&R time after a long drive from Delaware. A little dip in the pool, do him a world of good. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Juanita, how are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm about to go to sleep. I got to where I go to sleep every time I sit down. I wanted to say a few things about different things that sort of tie in.
Okay.
Well, I'll say something about the mountaintop removal. It seems like in every work in our country, or almost every work that I know about, that as the people in West Virginia and the other mining states have to suffer so a few may prosper, it seems that way to me in everything in this country, basically, more or less. You know what I'm saying? I know there's exceptions to the rule. And maybe there's some sections of the country that is less so. But it seems like there's most occupations that workers have the least consideration in wages, work conditions, civil amenities, and respect. They come last on the list, and these people become millionaires, such as our citrus millionaires down here, billionaires possibly. And they have known settlements of illegal workers who are treated much the same way as our citizens have been treated in the past and even today, causing them to feel worthless, dispensable to the almighty profiteering. And they taught us about communism. And of course, it was all horrible. And I know that Russia was a terrible country, and I know that the Chinese, any kind of dictatorship is terrible. But there's a piece that Karl Marx wrote, and it more and more, workers of the world unite.
You have nothing to lose but your chains.
And another thing I wanted to bring up was today is, I think today or this week is the anniversary of Tiananmen Square.
Yes, it is.
And a little history on this, a little minute history, is Papa Bush did nothing. He was the president then. When his son stole the presidency, he did nothing but a little small talk when one of our planes went down in Chinese territory.
So easy to forget that, isn't it? He apologized to the Chinese said, and if you don't give us back our plane now, I'll apologize again.
And then they took the plane apart, and being the easy learners they are, I'm sure they memorized everything about the plane. They got what they wanted and let the crew come home. Junior Bush did nothing. And then our Tiananmen Square, I'm reading a little bit of this. I'm getting
that's okay.
Like, our Tiananmen Square took place when we invaded Iraq, killing innocents and let them die in vain. Bush pomped and paraded his heroism, so-called heroism, by his cowardice in sending others to battle. Now Cheney wants to say there were no connections of Iraq to 9/11. He wants appreciation for his crimes toward others. And they do not involve just those who attacked us, but again, innocents, including our servicemen who died in vain. You know, Bob, I'll never forget about 4 years ago, I was in a doctor's office, and it was mostly elderly people, and they were talking about the war. It was kind of like when Cindy Sheehan first came out. They were talking about, well, you know, we can't stop, said all of our people have died. We don't want them to die in vain. And I said, what? You know, you want more people to die so they won't die in vain? It doesn't make any sense. But my point is, don't let these sadistic murderers go free with no accounting. I do believe that there'll be a day of reckoning in God's time, but I believe that those who call themselves Christians are lying to themselves if we don't investigate and interrogate. Kindly, of course, those butchers. Cindy Sheehan writes about those who say, leave that poor man alone, talking about Bush. Their pity is wasted. Why not leave that poor man Charlie Manson alone? The past is over. No murderer should be fairly be prosecuted and leave those poor people alone.
Yes, indeed.
And it said that a judge before he was a judge before had before him in a court a defendant who he defended as a lawyer. The defendant was charged with the same sort of crime, and when he was found guilty, the judge threw the book at him. He cried, Judge, why don't you have mercy on me? You have to clear my name before. The judge said, before I was only your defendant, I did my job. Now my job is to pass judgment on you. Your peers have found you guilty. I, as judge, am required to act on that burden. No mercy now, only justice.
Yeah, they never want the justice. It's all mercy. And you
know, Bob, you're talking about this mountaintop removal and all. And one little thing I heard in Obama's speech that bothered me again. It wasn't about that, but he was talking about turning nuclear power into a good thing.
Right.
You know, and, you know, I feel like we need to go more natural. We'll still, if we have those kind of things for our energy, we'll still be dependent on those.
Sure we will.
And be dependent on people to try to keep us safe from all of that stuff that comes out. Now they're trying to say, oh, you'll have all this waste from solar. You'll have all this waste from wind power. And I'm just, you know, the people in charge, all they care, it's just all money. It's the love of money, in my opinion. I just cannot see it. They don't want to listen to nothing. They don't want to listen about marijuana, how it could help people who are suffering. My son was just given some medication for pain. It's Loquat or something like that, Loquay. And he had to quit taking it because it's got Tylenol. And Tylenol is bad for anybody with liver problems. And
sure
my
is.
Son has had liver problems. So now he can't take that. And I don't like to see anybody going around being a pothead, but my God, have mercy on people like that. Something that would help people that get to where they can't eat, cancer patients, AIDS patients, they get to where they can't eat, and marijuana will help that. And also, if we can have the hemp, we can quit cutting down all our forests. We can just maybe use the good lumber, you know, for special uses.
Yes.
It's just so much, you know, it's just common sense, but our country don't want it. And all this stuff about sending stuff to China and all that kind of stuff, all this, everything you buy, made in China. I don't care how big, how small, what it is, it's got that big old thing on it, made in China. From the little teeny things you get, like whatnots or whatever, is made in China.
Yeah, it is.
And we got to. How are we going to take our country back? You know, I heard you talking to Jim Dean. Was it Jim?
Yeah.
Dean? Yeah. I think I'm going to see if I think you can take those courses at home, because I want to learn how to make my voice be heard and listened to. If there is some way, somehow, you know, what's the name? Just called and said he had tried to call your senators. Well, I've been thinking about it. I've been thinking about calling your governor and all like that. But I know one time I was contacted Nancy Pelosi, and they said, well, you know, she represents California. Well, I sent back something saying, well, doesn't she represent the whole country if she's Speaker of the House?
Take it a step further. Isn't that federal paycheck that she cashes every couple of weeks, whether she needs it or not, Isn't that a paycheck that's signed by each and every one of us?
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure that her paycheck isn't signed solely by the members of her district.
Yeah. But that's exactly what they told me. You know, and so most of my people that are in, they're Republicans, and they're Florida Republicans, and then I've got
Bill. Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, Bill. And, you know, they're not listening. It's like they're
mad. And you mainly feel that way because they're not.
They're not right. Now, I heard a little snippet on the news today that we're going to get a chance down here to vote to see whether we will allow them to drill for oil on our coast. Now, I just wonder how that's going to turn out.
I'm not a gambling man, but I'd hazard a guess.
Well, people are going to be brainwashed to think, oh, yeah, this is a good thing. We get all our oil here. But we got to get away from all that junk.
And the thing is, Juanita, they don't understand that we ain't necessarily, if we drill for that oil, there's no guarantee it's going to be kept here.
That's exactly right, just like you were saying about the coal. It's being sent to China. All that oil in Alaska, doesn't that go to China too?
I think a lot of it goes to Japan, maybe some
okay.
to China.
It don't go here.
Right. And see, that's one of the fundamental lies about drilling in the Anwar. You know, we've got to drill in the Anwar to protect America.
Yeah.
Only problem is the oil we got out of Anwar wouldn't go to America.
Yeah. I wanted to say one more thing, too, about the doctor that was murdered.
Yes. And I think we need to say a lot more about that because, A, I wasn't in a position to take calls or anything on Monday or Tuesday. And that murder is still fresh and raw in my psyche, and I imagine it is in a lot of people.
Well, what to compound how bad it is Rachel Maddow's been bringing up that pretty much the FBI was letting things ride. Because that guy, they had films of him where he would super glue their doors shut. And do all kind of vandalism around their place. They actually had the cameras on. And the only time that they knew that something was done and the man had to hide because of safety reasons was one time that they caught him and told him to leave him alone, and he did leave him alone for quite a while. But he was seen the day before. They contact the FBI every time. And he was seen the day before trying to glue. There was a woman there, and he was trying to glue the door together. He didn't know anybody was there. And he ran off, and they called, and they said that they couldn't do anything. Well, Rachel Maddow has found out that that is the federal crime to do all of that. He just done it several, and he was backed up by some place supposed to be right to life, you know. And the doctor was shot one time before.
Yeah, through both arms.
Completely, you know. I don't know. It's just it's like he didn't know.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting you would mention that, Juanita, because here in a few minutes. If everything works out as planned, we will be hearing from an artist, a singer and songwriter by the name of David Robix. And he's premiered, he's got a new song out there about the murder of Dr. Tiller.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be playing it this evening.
Okay.
And I will warrant that is probably him on the line right now. So we will continue this discussion. And you'll get to hear a new song about it.
Okay.
All right, Juanita, good to hear from you, dear. And
okay.
We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, night-night.
Good night. I am glad that Juanita brought up the issue of Dr. Tiller. As I said just ever so briefly on Monday, this is now, and you know, get this, I mean, I'm not that you don't, but two summers in a row now, right-wing murderers fueled by the hate that flows day by day, hour by hour, and minute by minute from the vast right-wing megaphone. Two murderers have gone into our churches and killed at will in what the right wing has created as a free fire zone. Think about that for a few minutes. They are at war with us. They are at war with you. They just are. And I do want to bring on the line right now David Rovics.
Hello, Bob. It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's a real pleasure for me, David. And I'm so glad you could join us this evening. And I've gotten to listen to the new song, and I have to tell you, it is stirring.
Thanks so much.
Tell me first of all. I mean, I've heard a lot of your music, and it transcends any sort of attempt to put any sort of broad banner over it. But what specifically, if there is a specific, what took you to the murder of Dr. Tiller and brought this song out?
Well, I was just I've just been in Europe for the past 5 weeks touring there, and been a bit out of touch with news in the U.S., mainly just been listening to BBC, which over there tends to really be about domestic news. So it's all been about mainly the expenses scandal in the British Parliament. But I was on a plane heading back to Portland and was reading actually the British newspaper The Guardian, which had an excellent bunch of articles about the murder of Dr. Tiller. And it was, I mean, of course, there's been so many doctors and other service providers at women's clinics killed and injured in the ongoing right-wing campaign of terror against the especially that aspect of the progressive movement. But it's there was something so particularly stirring and symbolic, I think, in so many ways, about Dr. Tiller and his murder. I mean, the fact that he had been targeted violently and shot actually twice before, that he has several kids, two daughters who are doctors, and I mean, he obviously must have been a real you know, very, very significant figure in their lives, obviously. But I mean, you know, that's seeing his on Pacifica Radio, I was hearing about his speech he gave, and he was a wonderful, wonderful guy. And then the fact that, of course, he was killed in church in front of his wife. I mean, it really just, yeah, it's just also, you know, the multiplied the tragedy in a way, you know, in so many ways with all that symbolism.
Well, let me thank you, first of all, for allowing us to put this up on the Horn website, this early version of the song. How long, obviously, you turned around and wrote this pretty quickly.
Yeah, I wrote it on the plane over, and then came up with the music late at night when I got back home, and recorded it the next morning on my little MP3 recorder, so it's not the highest quality recording in the world, but luckily my friend Chuck, you know, is good with making sort of not very good recording sound adequate, so he messed around with it, and it sounds not too bad now, I'd say.
It sounds great as far as I'm concerned, and folks can go to headonradionetwork.com. The post is New Music from David Rovics in the Name of God, and we're going to play it here in a little bit, David. But let me ask you just a little bit about what you've been up to lately. You've got a vast body of work. Is there a new compilation coming out soon?
Well, I'd like to do a new CD sometime soon, but I haven't actually made any plans. I always sort of wait around to see if there's any record labels that might be interested in doing something, and then eventually I do it myself anyway. I'll probably do a new CD sometime soon. But the most recent CD that I recorded was my children's CD last summer. So it's certainly been a while since I've done a new CD. So got about a good CD's worth of new material to record when I get around to it, hopefully soon.
Excellent. You know, we would, I don't, I'm speaking off the cuff, but we would love to have you down here in the hills and hollers of Appalachia for a little bit and let you turn your songsmithing gifts to what we're dealing with down here in the massacre of our hills.
Yeah, there's a lot to write about right there. I did write one song about that, actually, about the mountaintop removal in East Tennessee, but there's a heck of a lot more to be said about the horrors that are happening there as a result of rapacious corporations.
Well, let me ask you this, David. What are you thinking? How are you feeling about these first almost five months now of the Obama administration?
Well, I mean, I think that it's the foreign policy, especially, is looking pretty dismal, and it doesn't. I don't see any serious sign of things improving. I mean, it may be accurately stated that Obama has no intent to invade any new countries, but certainly there's three or so under direct U.S. occupation right now, and that doesn't seem to be changing. In terms of domestic policy, I think the banking bailout is pretty horrendous. Financial plan that's been backed by both parties, and I hope that the stuff about universal health care and high speed rail network and all that is true. That would be a big improvement over reality here for quite a while, but it doesn't look to me like there's any radical changes happening, which of course, even if he wants to be making radical changes, he doesn't have the kind of backing in the Congress that he'd need to do that anyway. So I don't know, how much, to blame him and how much to blame the system that he's trying to work with, to whatever extent he's trying to work with it. But, it doesn't look too good to me.
Well, I would think that knowing the tenor of your work, David, I would think that what is being done to American workers with the GM bankruptcy will certainly have to stir your creative juices. I know you said that you were out of the loop for a while since you were in Europe, but it does look like the American working class is just continuing to take it on the chin, doesn't it?
It sure does. I mean, it's 160,000 job losses every month, and certainly, GM and all the major corporations in the U.S., certainly the auto industry especially, has been laying off hundreds of thousands of workers for decades now. Because of automation and because of building factories in the third world where they can get people to work a lot cheaper, exploit low environmental standards and all that. So what's happening with GM now is just the latest blow, but certainly anybody that's seen Roger and me over 10 years ago has a good idea about how devastated Flint and other centers of GM former employment have been devastated, So it's the corporate globalization continues and continues to be a horrible thing for the American working class, and also a horrible thing for the working class around the world. In fact, it's often assumed, I think, by a lot of people who don't really understand what's happening, that the working class in other countries are benefiting at the expense of the American working class, but actually workers around the world are suffering as a result of this globalization. It's not a benefit to the Mexican working class to have jobs in an auto industry when they're paid 50 cents an hour. This is not...
Right, or India or China, for that matter.
Exactly.
You're not exactly living the life of Riley when you're chained to a sewing machine or stuck to an assembly line in Vietnam gluing soles onto Nikes or Reeboks for 13 hours a day.
Exactly. Dying at an average age, as the Nike workers in Indonesia do, of 26.
Good God. 26?
It's 26, which is the same age, incidentally, that workers 100 years ago at the Lawrence Mills breathing cotton dust all day long like the Nike workers in Indonesia do. That's the same age that they used to die at on average as a result of working, all their waking hours breathing cotton dust. You know, they would die of black lung, the same like miners would, except instead of coal dust, they're breathing cotton dust.
When you go in, I know you spend a substantial amount of time traveling and performing, David. What kind of responses do you get? What kind of venues do you play when you go outside the United States?
A lot of community centers and a lot of pubs and function rooms of pubs where in Britain there's a whole tradition of, pubs that have large function rooms which are basically sort of theaters where they serve beer, essentially. And which is the people that do acoustic music like me would much more often play in a place like that, whereas in the U.S., people on the kind of circuit I'm in would be playing some combination of folk clubs and Unitarian churches, but they don't do they don't have the Unitarian churches over there. They have pubs. And so,
I like the beer part. I hate to seem shallow, but I do.
I know, and most other people do as well. The fact is, when I tour in the U.S. with my English friend Attila the Stockbroker, who's a punk rock poet and songwriter, when he comes to the U.S. with me, he brings beer into the churches, which it never really occurred to me to do. I always sort of lament the fact that they don't serve beer in the churches, but then, get over it. But he actually brings the beer in and sticks it on the altar. And, we didn't get too many complaints about it, but it was a bit...
And I have to ask a favor, David. You mentioned an artist with a name like Attila the Stockbroker, and you tell me that he's punk and he's a poet. You got to put me in touch with him. I got to hear some of this stuff, if that wouldn't be too much trouble.
Oh, absolutely. AttilaTheStockbroker.com. He's got lots of MP3s and stuff on his website, and I'm sure he'd love to do an interview, and I'm sure it would be entertaining.
So you are home for a little bit now, though.
Yeah.
Are you gonna work stateside for a while, back into the Unitarian churches?
Well, I'll be doing in a bit over a week. I'll be doing a little tour, heading out to Toledo and New York City, and then back over to British Columbia, Nashville. I don't think I'm doing any churches. There might be maybe one or two of those gigs are in churches. Yeah, they are. I think in Victoria and Vancouver, BC, they're both in churches. So yeah, I'll be playing in some churches and some other sort of music.
What's your, just out of curiosity, and none of my business, what's your 4th of July looking like?
4th of July is, there's a socialist conference in the San Francisco area that I've been in touch with some of the organizers, and I was thinking I might be there, but I'm not hearing back from them, so it may be just wide open. I'm not sure.
Well, if it is, there is something that happens around the 4th of July every year up on Kayford Mountain here in West Virginia. The Mountain Keepers Music Festival, and I think it's I think it's still on for this year. And wow would I love to see you there.
I'd love to be there.
I'll make some inquiries and see if that's still going on, and I'll get a date and I'll shoot it back to you because you might be a natural fit. I'm not a spokesman for the operation or anything, but it would be a marvelous thing to see and hear.
Well, I'd love to make it out there, and I do have some I think pretty good songs about West Virginia. I could we might be able to find them on the web and play them on the show if you want to.
Oh, great! Yes, absolutely.
One's called "The Battle of Blair Mountain" about the 1921.
I remember. I've heard that, and that is brilliant.
All right.
And we're trying to save Blair Mountain now, David.
Does it still exist, or has it been mountaintop removed?
No, it still exists. The fight is ongoing. It was rather an interesting development a couple of months ago. The National Register of Historic Places announced that they were going to list Blair Mountain.
All right.
And there was an outcry. The governor of West Virginia himself interceded to say, "You can't do that. There are several property owners who object." Because as you well know, our country is not very good at teaching its labor history.
That's for sure, yeah.
And one of the things that the coal companies would love to do is simply erase Blair Mountain forever so that there's not even anywhere to put a historical marker.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they almost did that to Walden Pond. I mean, it's
yes.
outrageous.
I remember Don Henley getting involved with the
Don
Walden.
Yeah, Don Henley. Yeah. If it weren't for Don Henley, we might not have a Walden Pond anymore. There's already a dump directly across the street from the pond. But the pond's still there, thanks to Don.
And there, anywhere, you know, how can you find much more than a historical marker of things like Flint or the Haymarket or the Triangle Shirtwaist factory building?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a constant. It's a constant effort to deprive the American people of their history. In fact, you might be interested to know this. There's an organization in southern West Virginia, David, called Cedar. We all love cedars, don't we? I mean, it's lovely smelling wood. We put it in the blocks to keep the moths away and make our sweaters smell good. Well, in southern West Virginia, cedar means something entirely different. It's a propaganda program whereby the coal industry goes in and tells fourth graders how good coal is for them.
Oh, my goodness.
There is absolutely no end to the corporate attempts to recast our history, but
yeah.
you have an especial gift for making sure that history doesn't disappear and doing so in a way that's catchy and makes we refer to them as earworms. When you get one of those little songs that just won't get out of your head and you just go around singing a snippet of it for two or three days at a time, you got a bunch of those.
Mm. I do my best.
And you do it very well. Well, David, I wish you the very best in your ongoing travels, and I want to make sure that we play the tune for folks now.
Sure.
All right.
Thanks very much. Good talking to you.
My pleasure, and I hope we'll hear from you again. Let us know if you pull the disc together. We want to help you move a few copies.
Oh, you bet.
All right, I'll be in touch, and thanks for hooking up for a conversation on such short notice.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime, Bob. Thank you.
All right. Take care, David.
Take care.
Bye now. Singer, songwriter, activist in his own right, David Rovics, calling in from Portland, Oregon. Let's go ahead and hear this, because this is a stunning new song, and it's a great jumping off place for a discussion about Dr. Tiller and what this means. A new song from David Rovics, In the Name of God. Pretty much kind of exclusive to the horn, no less. Go to headonradionetwork.com, the blog there. New music from David Rovics, In the Name of God is the name of the post, and you can listen to it all you want. David Rovics.
Pistol pointed at the doctor's head. In the name name of God, he pulled the trigger. Now the doctor's lying dead. This is not Afghanistan. It's the heartland, USA, where a girl has to wonder if she'll get acid in her face, where they bomb the women's clinics because the creature told them to, where the man there on the TV tells them that's what they should do. In the name of God, he held his pistol pointed at the doctor's head. In the name of God, he pulled the trigger. Now the doctor's lying dead. In the name of God. In the name of God.
Wow. In the name of God, David Rovics. And you can get all of David's music at davidrovics.com, davidrovics.com. And I'm going to check out Attila the stockbroker, too, and find some. We'll be playing a little bit more of David's music lately, or soon, I think. The Battle of Blair Mountain is a stunning piece of work. And, you know, it's the kind of music that you're not going to turn on a clear channel station and hear. Art is best appreciated when you have to make some sort of effort to appreciate the art, as opposed to just passively turning on a radio button, pushing a radio button, or being in your car, and you know the radio was on, so necessarily you'll just sit and hear the latest pap flowing out of the corporate music world. The good stuff ain't there. The good stuff is independent. The good stuff is music that you have to, you know, the stuff that gets passed around. Hey, did you hear? Yeah, did you hear? Hey, what about? Yeah. And David Rovics is one of those. David Rovics, davidrovics.com. And also, something I've been meaning to bring to your attention for a while. Some time back, our good friend Scott in Massachusetts called to tell us about his ongoing project. Do you remember Make the Path? Well, I had an email update from Scott not too awfully long back, toward the end of May, and I just wanted to let you know. He says, things are moving along with Make the Path toward an initial release. And there is a new Friends of Make the Path update that describes recent happenings in the project. Just go to makethepath.com, and there's a 2009-5-26 Friends of Make the Path Entry 2. And if you click on the path icon in the blog post, you can learn all you want to know about the project. Scott says there's going to be a test ride soon, and is inviting folks to become part of the seed community that sets the project in motion. He says, we truly value your continued support. It's what makes a project like this possible and worth doing in the first place. And that's one of the most gratifying things about what happens for me here. And that is watching, knowing that what happens on the Horn is intimately connected with people who are doing their own activism on their own and creating their portion of a vision for a sustainable, viable, peaceful, hopeful, encouraging future. So go to makethepath.com and have a look. We're right at just about halfway past the third hour of the program. Oh, I'd say there's a good 20, 25 minutes left of conversation if you want to jump in. The conversation's fine. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877-4-HEAD-ON. Email rolls in to bobkincaid@gmail.com. That's bobkincaid@gmail.com. Yeah, your comments are welcome there. And if you have never been, if you've never been to the Head On Radio Network chat room, headonradionetwork.com/chatroom, this would be a lovely opportunity to try it out in these last few minutes. There's always scintillating conversation going on there. So I encourage you to do so. And you know how it goes. You don't have to be necessary. There's no such thing as on topic with this program because you are the topic. And you literally drive the program itself. I'm just looking around here because I wanted to see if it may be a little bit too much to try to get my head around at the moment, but I will be playing some more of David Rovich's music for you. Going back to a few of the other issues, just to sort of clear out my mind or the cluttered desk that is my mind. If you were listening to the Green News Report, you heard the name of Rick Boucher, Democrat of Virginia, mentioned. I've seen some pretty shameless examples of corporate welfare out there, but this is stunning. Because we've talked about it, you know that within the ACES bill, otherwise known as Marky Waxman, you know that there's $10 billion of corporate welfare for carbon capture and storage, the boondoggle, rat hole, waste of your money. Well, Rick Boucher got to thinking, and he understands the nature of how money flows, I suppose. Democrat from Virginia, Rick Boucher. And he loves him some coal. And he loves him some coal welfare. Well, guess what Rick Boucher has succeeded in doing? He realized that somebody's going to have to give away those $10 billion. There's got to be somebody who has the shovel to take those $10 billion and shovel them into the rat hole. Okay? Well, that don't come cheap. So guess what? He has succeeded in incorporating wholesale. As pages 52 to 75, this according to the Solve Climate blog, pages 52 to 75 of the American Clean Energy and Security Act, the ACES Act, you know, Marky Waxman, something that he calls the Carbon Storage Research Corporation. The Carbon Storage Research Corporation is going to get up to $500 million. And the designation for what happens to those $500 million is, quote, administrative expenses. The money will be spent at the discretion of the officers of the Carbon Storage Research Corporation. Here's a hint. You, me, us, none of us are going to be officers of that corporation. The Carbon Storage Research Corporation, I'd love to pervert that. Because the best way to use $10 billion in the or give away $10 billion in the Carbon Storage Research Corporation would be to research ways to transition from coal-fired electricity toward wind, solar, geothermal, tidal, all the myriad sustainable and ecologically tolerable energy production methods. Carbon Storage Research Corporation. It seems to me that whether one believes in God and creation, or whether one believes in thinks that the facts are the facts and things are as they are because of the way they developed, that the Earth or God developed a pretty good means of storing carbon. It was buried under the ground. That's where it became coal. And should have stayed under the ground. Begins how it's all poison and everything. That would be fun. But no, what's going to happen is, you might live somewhere where you think what happens with Appalachian coal doesn't touch you. You're wrong, because I don't care where you live in these United States. Here in a little bit, if this goes through, if this stays in the bill, you're going to get hit with an assessment. It's not a tax, it's an assessment. They would average about 50 cents a month for every electricity ratepayer in the country to fund the Carbon Storage Research Corporation. They can't even, that $10 billion down that rat hole, they can't even use some of that $10 billion to fund the Carbon Storage Research Corporation. No. Because that's all coal welfare money, and coal gets it all. They get to dip into the till again. Till my rear end. They get to dip into your wallet to fund the boondoggle to make sure that the right silk purses are filled with the right filthy lucre. Man, what a beautiful dodge that is. I learned about all this, by the way, over at Coal Tattoo, the Coal Tattoo blog at wvgazette.com. Ken Ward's blog, it's on down the left-hand side. It says Coal Tattoo. Click on it. That's how you keep up with everything of note within the environmental struggle, environmental news coming out of Appalachia. Rick Boucher, remember the name. That guy's right up the... That's almost like being a legalized bank robber, isn't it? Why, yes. Yes, it is. Let's go to the phones and see what's happening. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Cassie.
Hey, Cassie. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm a high school senior.
School started already?
No, I finished my junior year.
Okay. You've got the promotion by virtue of finishing junior. So you're set. Congratulations.
Thanks.
You'll feel a lot more like a senior when the classes start, though, won't you?
Well, yeah. Yeah. But I'm actually going to be looking at a bunch of colleges over the summer. And a few of them, well, a few have invited me out, and then I'm going to visit others on the way.
Wonderful.
Dare we
ask who the lucky colleges are?
No. Not yet.
Then we won't.
Not yet. I'll let you know. First of all, we're not 100% certain. We've kind of got a route mapped out, but it's not completely set what I'm going to be looking at.
So is that what your summer is going to be, looking at colleges? Are you going to do any summer learning programs or anything?
I don't have anything going right now. I'm working at Subway, making sandwiches.
Eat fresh!
But I don't have anything I don't have any programs that I'm involved with.
So are you an accomplished sub sandwich technician by now?
I am.
So if I say BMT, you immediately know what's on that.
Yes.
Oh dear.
Anyway, so actually the reason that I wanted to call, I know that you've talked a little bit about the murder of the doctor in Kansas.
Yes.
And did you notice how many newspapers called him an abortionist and how few of them said doctor or gynecologist or, you know, like they finally settled on abortion provider, but on Sunday all the news was abortion doctor, you know, dies, not human being
murdered by right winger. Yeah. And get them.
You have to go to the lefty blogs to even see, you know, words like terrorism or murdered.
I know.
Anyway.
Well, now that's because the right wing controls the way that issues are framed in this country. You know, how many years? Even now. O'Reilly is still calling him names. It's astonishing. These right wingers have no shame. And even though I know a bunch of anti-abortion groups came out and said, "Well, you know, we decry the use of violence," and you know, if you
they encourage it.
Sure, they do.
It's really scary. It's really scary that the FBI knew what was going on and didn't protect him. And the FBI, the guy who they think did it, the guy who did it, he has done so much stuff in like the last 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years. Why wasn't he in jail? Like, if he'd been doing that much harassment to somebody that was not an abortion provider, he would have been in jail the whole time.
Well, you know, for instance, that I'm not a proponent of the death penalty. I'm not. Mm-hmm. But even though I'm not a proponent of the death penalty, I can't help asking, you know, Eric Rudolph did the Atlanta bombing in 1996 and then went on the run and hid out for years. And when he was finally captured and tried, the Bush administration Justice Department said they had no interest whatsoever in pursuing the death penalty against him, and he's a domestic terrorist. Okay? Tried in state court in Tennessee, Adkisson, who marched into the Unitarian Fellowship in Knoxville last summer and blew away people, they didn't want to give him the death penalty.
They don't care what happens. The newspapers and the for-profit media, they don't care what happens to liberals. They don't care what happens in liberal churches.
No, they don't.
Which is really awful. I mean, like, you know, our life is valuable unless they're liberal.
Kind of makes you feel that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, listen, there was one other thing I wanted to talk to you about.
Mm-hmm.
I would call John Fox's program if he would come back on the air.
And he will. We're working on that.
Okay, but he's not, so I'm going to call you. And there was a 17-year-old kid somewhere northwest, like maybe Oregon, somewhere, either Oregon or Washington up there, who gave a speech at school about marijuana and how the pot laws ought to change and that they should legalize marijuana. And then in front of this whole school, like, assembly thing, he took out a joint and started smoking it.
Yes.
And got arrested.
Right. We will not tolerate unlawful activity on school grounds. Right?
Yeah. Well, I wonder if they arrest kids that call other kids baby killers?
No. No. And they don't arrest kids who call other kids any number of epithets or torture kids or torment kids. While I was the first morning I woke up in D.C. This past week, Cassie, I read a story in the Washington Post about a mother who had done everything in her power to protect her son, just nice young man, even so far as changing schools and moving, changing homes, and limited the young man's whereabouts. You know, he wasn't allowed to ride more than a half a mile up and half a mile strip up and down the street in front of their home, that kind of stuff. And a couple of the kids from the school came up and punched him in the head while he was on his bicycle, knocked him to the ground, he hit his head on the pavement, and he died.
Oh, my God.
And I just sat there, honest to goodness, Cassie, I sat there reading that story, and I wept.
That's horrible.
She had begged the school system to do something about it. She had done everything in her power about it. The boy's father, they were divorced, but apparently they were amicable enough to co-parent. The boy's father is a sheriff's deputy in, I'm not sure, one of those Maryland counties, or maybe Virginia counties near D.C.
And they couldn't protect him.
And they could not protect him.
Well, I mean, it's like restraining orders don't protect people either.
No, the restraining orders only work on people who are willing to be restrained by them. It's just stunning business. So, in answer to your question, the young man gets arrested for, and I did read the story, and he was arrested for suspicion of possession of marijuana.
Well, if they search him, why is it suspicion? I mean, he had it in his hand.
No, see, that's the problem, though. You have to be busted with it. The young man lit the joint, smoked the joint, put the joint out, put the joint in his mouth, chewed it up, and swallowed it.
So they couldn't put it in evidence?
No evidence to put it in. I mean, there's no evidence.
Well, maybe it'll get people talking about if this stuff should be legal.
I certainly hope that it does.
You know, it's not the same as heroin. It's not the same as cocaine. It's not the same as meth.
It's not.
It's just not.
And in fact, it has, it has more salutary uses. I remember when... I remember when we were either immediately before or immediately after September the 11th, 2001, Cassie, which was a long, long time ago for you, I understand, in terms of how much of your life that was. I remember when John Ashcroft, the Attorney General of the United States, was using the full force and weight of the government to make sure that he sent Tommy Chong to prison for a website called Chong's Bongs.
You can't have a website that talks about pot?
Apparently you can't have one that sells them.
But you can buy a bong without buying a pot, right?
Sure. I mean, yes, absolutely. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad that you got back from D.C., and we missed having a prayer meeting yesterday.
I did, too. And there was no way that I was going to be back in time to do a show because the train that runs is scheduled to arrive at 6:30 p.m. at my station, and then it's another 30 minutes or so home. But I hate missing any show, but I hate particularly missing prayer meeting.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll talk to you later.
All right, and you know, I know it may seem kind of well, I hope it doesn't seem like menial or drudge work or anything, but I'm proud of you for going out and getting a job. I really am.
Oh, thanks.
And it'll be nice to have a little bit of pocket change. Won't be a lot.
No, it's not a lot of money, but I'm sorry.
But it'll be enough to it'll be enough to make some put you some traveling cash in your pocket for when you go visiting colleges and so forth, colleges that are as yet to be named later.
Right.
But I got a feeling you're picking some pretty good ones.
Mostly in the south.
Yeah, I need to look up east, but you know, I know.
A couple of.
I know you're afraid of the snow. Okay. I know.
I'm not afraid of it. Well,
they sell, you know, they do sell cold weather clothing up there. They're kind of used to it. But
yeah.
I know. But we'll talk about that again some other time.
Okay.
Good to hear from you, Cassie.
Bye.
Take care. Bye. Author of the Political Teen Tidbits blog, that's Cassie. FrecklesCassie.wordpress.com. See, I got it right, I think. FrecklesCassie, FrecklesCassie.wordpress.com. Go and look at what she does. She's a very, very good young writer, and we're awfully proud of all the hard work she puts in. 8 minutes left in the program. Let's at least close with a something maybe at least a little bit hopeful. Hopeful? No, it's just fact. It's the natural world. It's the story of a couple of penguins. It's out of Berlin. You know how they are. A German zoo, according to the Associated Press, says a pair of gay male penguins are raising a chick from an egg abandoned by its parents. There's a zoo at Bremerhaven. The zoo has a veterinarian. The veterinarian's name is Joachim Schöne. He says the egg was placed in the male penguin's nest after its parents rejected it in late April. The male pair of penguins incubated it for about 30 days before it hatched. And after the hatch, they have continued to care for it and raise it. The zoo there has three pairs of same-sex penguins among the 20 Humboldt penguins that they have that have attempted to mate. The two penguins' names are Zett and Vierpunkt. And the zoo issued a statement on its website saying, quote, "Sex and coupling in our world don't always have something to do with reproduction." There's a photograph of the two Humboldt penguins standing guard over the entrance to their little cave to make sure that the little one is safe. Male and female created he them. I guess Fred Phelps out in Wichita, Kansas, will soon have to have a website up. God hates penguins. But maybe the realization of reality is catching on. Because I believe it was today that New Hampshire finally passed marriage equity in that state. And that bodes well for freedom in America. It also bodes well for freedom in America that Hal Turner an obnoxious, vile, hate-filled, right-wing, subhuman, has been arrested in New Jersey. Our friend Maura pointed this out, this story out to me. Turner faces accusations of having incited his listeners and readers to take up arms and of singling out two Connecticut lawmakers and a state ethics official. As of this afternoon, he was still in jail with bail set at $25,000. Hal Turner is a white supremacist. He's also an anti-Semite of vile proportions. He's also a friend of Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity has known connections to Hal Turner. He posted the following on his blog with a promise to release the home addresses of State Representative Michael Lawler, State Senator Andrew McDonald, and Thomas Jones of the State Ethics Office. The blog said, "It is our intent to foment direct action against these individuals personally. These beastly government officials should be made an example of as a warning to others in government. Obey the Constitution or die." What was it all about? It was about a controversy in state about a bill before the legislature's Judiciary Committee that would have changed the way the Roman Catholic Church is governed and taking away power from the church officials and turning it over to lay members. The bill got pulled. But the issue came to light again last week, when the Diocese of Bridgeport filed a federal lawsuit against state ethics officials who are investigating whether church officials violated lobbying laws by organizing a rally at the state capitol to protest the measure earlier in the spring. And out of that, Hal Turner unilaterally decided that human beings needed to die. We talked to Dave Nauert at the conference in D.C. about his new book, The Eliminationists. There's another example. They are all around, and they mean you no good. Murder and death and misery are what conservatism has at its base. Time to roll. Great to be back in the home studio. Great to have you around this evening. Hope you'll be back tomorrow night for Friday on the front porch here on the Horn. Thank you for making June possible. We have to work on July now. And it's going to take another heroic effort. Thank you to everybody who stepped up so boldly last month. And thank you to those of you who, even if you cannot, keep the program going with your thoughts and your ideas. If you can contribute to the program, there's a PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com, or you can do snail mail. The address is there as well. And having contributed or contributing again, you will know that you are making sure that this pioneering effort at redefining radio will continue. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch, to our moderators in the chat room, Sue, Lottie, to our blogger, Texas Betsy, to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you, everyone. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and Coal River Wind thebravestheartist.org. The bravest, hardest working people I know. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.